So this is non-Western settings in fantasy. Descriptions, we're seeing more and more writers use non-Western settings in fantasies these days. N.K. Jemisin, Bradley Beaulieu. I never pronounce his name.
You're right, Beaulieu's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Salah and Ahmed, just to name a few. How well are these working for us? Does a scenery scene just seem tacked on, or is it integral to the story? Does this trend work equally well for doorstopper fantasy as it does for sword and sorcery, or do American readers not have the patience to deal with it for that long? Come join us to talk about how it might fit in your fantasy. Well, I mean, that obviously is a little ethnocentric just to start with, since it's, you know, specifically American. Among English speakers, readers in the UK are probably going to be a lot more open to non-Western stories, just because, you know, North America, at least in, well, the United States, tends to be fairly isolationist even now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But do you want to, I don't have any questions whatsoever.
Would you want to introduce yourself and I'll do the same? Yeah, and then
that would be useful. Hi, I'm Brent Kilmer. I write epic fantasy, and before I started writing professionally, I was a history professor, primarily teaching, well, my main areas were Middle Ages and Late Antique Period, and one of my subcategories was Middle Eastern and Near Eastern history.
Okay. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in fantasy and science fiction and creative writing, and also an author with a novel called The Third Sign a couple of years ago, others being shopped a Kickstarter for a novel being turned into a graphic novel called Icarus, which will be out in September, that funded at $16,000, which was great. And then a number of short stories, including an anthology, which I'm co-editing on speculative fiction and politics. And my other hat is that I co-host the podcast Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, with, thank you, with Brad Beaulieu. That's how I know his name. Brad's a good friend and my co-host on that show. And we have interviewed, in fact, so Brad, who's mentioned in this, is part of the podcast, and we have interviewed and done triptychs on the work of Nora Jemisin and Saladin Ahmed and others. So we've talked a lot about, actually, some of the trends and looking at things like non-Western settings in fantasy and otherwise. So that's me.
So yeah. Why don't you start off?
Okay. Well, one thing I was thinking about kind of in setting up for this is one of the questions that gets asked, and you even see it a little bit as you pointed out in the description, is what the default is, right? What's the sort of default characters that we look at? What are the default settings that we consider? An example that I'm going to give, because it's fresh in my mind, I've only just a few weeks ago gotten done teaching A Wizard in Earthsea in my introductory fantasy fiction course. So one of the things that's interesting about that book is when students first encounter it, and I actually had the same experience way back when I, you know, read it when I was young, their usual feeling is they tend to really like it, they tend to be really interested in it, and then they tend to be really shocked when we start looking at who the various races are of the people in that novel, because, as you all probably know if you've read the book, Ged is in fact dark-skinned, and in fact, many of the characters, if not most of the characters that he interacts with, are dark-skinned and all various hues. Now, there's many reasons for this. Part of it, though, a major reason, is that Le Guin was an anthropologist by training, so she was interested in looking at a world that reflected realism, as opposed to just looking at a particular subset of Western Europe from which we derive, right, a whole ton of fantasy from there. And when I showed my students, after having talked to them about the anthropological basis of it and, you know, what island cultures would be involved in, because obviously there's a lot of that in this book as well, right around the break, it's a night course, so I send them off and they come back from their break kind of processing and cogitating all of that. I show them a little clip from the what's that? If you have nothing nice to say, don't say it. From the movie by Sci-Fi called Legend of Earthsea.
That alone is not
nice. Yeah. It started with Sci-Fi and just got worse from there, or whatever they're calling themselves, Sci-Fi or whatever the heck their new name is. But anyway, and if you've ever seen this, it's a terrible, terrible movie. Dreadfully paced. It compresses together Wizard of Earthsea and Tombs of Acheron. It tries to fit that together into some bizarre miniseries for it. It just doesn't work. But worst of all, beyond all of the other problems, is that it whitewashes the book to an incredible degree. It makes Ged white, for one thing. And the only person who is dark-skinned, as far as I can tell for the majority of the movie, is Ogeon, played by Danny Glover. Because we need to have a black man helping the white man, again, apparently, in a fantasy. So it's not only offensive, it's troubling insofar as it's going directly against what Le Guin said was really important in trying to establish a new way of looking at fantasy. All of which is a rather long-winded way to say that I think the default position that we look at a lot, which is that most fantasies begin from being Western European, and anything which isn't Western European is off or strange or different or novel or exotic or, you know, very much like a 19th century travelogue where the default is the Western European position and everything else is sort of different. That creates real issues for us, I think, as authors. And it creates issues for us when we sit down and write something and when someone asks, well, you know, why is it that you have principally white men? Why is it you have, you know, very few women in any kind of position, but more importantly, you have very almost no one of any color in this novel at all? And the response is, well, it just happened to turn out that way. Okay, but it always happens to just turn out that way, right? It always ends up being this position. And I think one of the things that shows us is that what we've got to do as authors, leave aside an academic study of it, is be more conscious of decisions that we're making and look to establish, if not a different default, at least a different sort of baseline from which we can operate, so that we don't have to have stories that Le Guin herself told of having fans of color coming up to her and thanking her for writing a book where they could see themselves. Shouldn't have taken until the 60s and 70s to begin that process, and it shouldn't be something that we're still kind of batting about in 2014, yet here we are, and we still have that assumption, that default assumption. And so questioning what our default actually is and looking at books like Saladin Ahmed's Throne of the Crescent Moon, which is sword and sorcery, and I think that's part of where the description is coming from, which is an exquisitely well-done book, or a book like Alia Dubedard's Servant of the Underworld, which, although it is set in the Western Hemisphere, is talking about Aztec culture and therefore is again providing us something different from the norm. Looking at a different version of the default, I think, is what we need to do. So, sorry, yeah.
I just had one of the things that bothers me a lot is it's as if the only pale-skinned people are what we consider white European descendants. There are a lot of people from other parts of the world who lived in similar climates who had palish skins.
Right.
It's as if European descendants is the only people we can even imagine in this, you know.
Assimilated.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's tons of people all over the world who have very different cultures who lived in similar environments.
Right.
And, you know, the way I see it is that, you know, this default, I mean,
honestly,
it's the default, at least partially because a large amount of fantasy is written by Americans and British, I mean the English language fantasy,
mm-hmm.
and the majority of them tend to be Caucasian, European descendant. But, you get in the habit of write what you know. Oh, I'm white, so I'll write, write that way. But the problem with the default is just writing the default is lazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only lazy, it's uninteresting, because honestly, there's a huge amount of stuff out there that is fascinating, and it's really cool, and quite apart from that, it's not overdone.
It's problematic, too, in speculative fiction, in that since we're in a genre where the idea is to think about what if, and to constantly push boundaries and expand and look at other aspects of the way that the world could be, that makes it even worse in a way, right? That we're constantly returning to the same thing. Listen, I grew up with Lord of the Rings, and it got me fired up and interested in reading in the first place. And I will never, I'm not going to ever, you know, put it, throw it away and say this is a piece of junk because it happens to be what it is. But it is one thing, and it's one thing among a panoply of work that has come out and been produced increasingly by not just writers of color, but by people like Brad, for example, who is a, you know, white male who was writing about stuff, now currently writing in a more Arabian setting, and his new work, The 12 Kings of Sharakai, which is going to be coming out from DAW, is set in that world. He's interested in broad, and this first series was set in kind of a combination of Persia and Muscovite Russia. These are things that I think more of these things need to be looked at if we're going to start kind of changing that default and looking at other things. So it's not to remove one thing, it's to say that will get covered plenty. That's not going to go away, but we have got to do a better job of being able to expand more broadly. And I have to say that this is one place where so-called literary mainstream fiction is outpaced us rather considerably in genre. You know, it's part of the reason that the British could look at this is because people like V.S. Naipaul and, you know, were writing about, or later on Derek Walcott or people like that, are writing about the experience of leaving their land to go somewhere and be able to write about the place from which they came. And I think that's significant, too, because a lot of what we're talking about here is trying to, again, establish different frames of reference and being able to then pick from those different frames of reference and use those different frames of references rather than always returning to the same one. Yeah. You're very excited to ask me when to take it off. That's okay. Yeah, sure.
You're talking about defaults, and I mean, not really default. Default is a place word in this sentence, but at least this, the first default is a place word in this sentence. Or this paragraph, whatever. Paying too much attention because my sister's a grammar Nazi. Every person has their, almost has their own default. Like, again, that's the placer. There is a common default because the same people are writing, like, similar people are writing, people from similar backgrounds are writing. So, like, they have similar enough experiences that you're going to see similar problems in their work where, like, well, this isn't covered. Well, that's because they don't know that, and that happens over and over again because they don't know that. And so, like, and that's the thing, like, so when the thing, popular works that are, very rarely do you see a popular work that is not, like, just kind of, like, the whole exotic, because either they, like, sometimes they make a huge mistake, and whether it's popular or not, but they make a huge mistake, and they don't know anything about it, and they're making everything exotic, even though there's, from a point of view of someone from there, which makes no sense, and...
Right, why would the person from that culture view it as exotic when they're living inside the culture?
But that's why you only really, usually you only see... with the books I read, because I intentionally avoid the books that are from that point of view and don't do it right. That's why you see only, like, from going into an exotic, like, just being breathed into this new world, and you're seeing this, like, almost like kind of a hero story of, like, realizing the world around you. And I think, like, that has a lot to do with writing, having a background and then writing a character. Instead of writing a character and then building a background.
I agree.
That's what I prefer to do.
Yeah. Well, I do want to say, though, and I agree with a lot of that, I do want to say, though, that I think it's also important to recognize the very large number and rapidly growing number of writers of color who have been producing work for a long time. The fact that we were not aware of them is on us, not on them, or that they weren't producing in the first place. So one of the things I'd want to say is that if you look even at fantasies that come from, let's say, from China, from Japan, that are books, and I know you weren't saying this, this is just giving me a chance to kind of to riff off of that, that part of what we were doing then was not being willing to actually, first of all, the work wasn't ending up in translation, which made it more difficult. And then secondly, there was an assumption, which I think is part of what gets reflected in that description you mentioned at the very beginning, that, well, people aren't going to put up with it. you know, I don't accept this from on its face. I think that good writing is good writing on a basic level. Leave aside any of the sort of cultural aspects of it that we've been talking about. But moreover, I think it has sort of cheapened, lessened the genre that it's taken us this long to be able to start broadening out. Not, I think, because of lack of work, but I think from lack of interest in seeking out that work. And hopefully, because of a huge increase in independent publishing, in small publishing, in people being able to produce work that doesn't necessarily rely on going through the big five now, soon to be big one, that doesn't rely on the big five, that we're going to get an opportunity to kind of see these from other places. So I do think that's there. So again, that's not to counter what you said, but it's just to sort of add to it and to say there is a great deal of work out there that I think it's important for people to be able to analyze too.
And certainly the reception of Saladin Ahmed's Throne of the Crescent Moon, which is, if you haven't read it...
Can you say that title?
Sure, it's called The Throne of the Crescent Moon. It's an excellent, excellent book. And by the way, it's extremely, extremely entertaining because Saladin actually was writing it he was driven by D&D. You know, Saladin's a Dungeons & Dragons geek like me. You know, he grew up loving that stuff. And that's kind of what he does. And I think it's interesting because, he's writing it from an Eastern perspective, and he's writing it from a perspective of, you would look at it, you would look at the cover and think to yourself that you're going to be getting something of a particular bent. You know, he sort of said, that was a part of the book, but I also just wanted to write a really cool adventure story, which is another issue, right? Which is the assumption that you read a book that's not Western, and the assumption must be, I will be given cultural artifacts of enormous significance and everything. No, you might also just get a damn good book that's written as it's written that is an adventure story. So I kind of reject on its face the idea that that people won't accept books of a certain length if it's not dealing with West at Y. I don't see that at all, especially when you're talking about good writing from the get-go. So
there was without question a time that it would have clearly been the case that people would have rejected, at least in the United States, something that wasn't Western. But
a while ago, though.
This is 2014.
A while ago, yeah.
Hmm? Pardon?
I can think of Orientals, Mid-East Oriental stuff, and Mid-East Arabian Night stuff, and Japanese have been floating around for decades.
It has, but there's also... It hasn't been as widely popular in the genre as would be
okay,
nice.
Yes, but they don't rival Eddings.
But this is... like we said, this is 2014 now, and frankly, the reception of Saladin Ahmed's work is, Daw, snapped it up, and it's hugely popular.
Or Nora Jemison, work that's coming out of Orbit, work that's coming out of Pyre. These are the same kinds of things that are sort of approaching it, and I do think that that's... There may have been a time when that was commercially true. I agree. I don't think that's true now, though.
But people are still seem to be acting as if it is.
Right, and it's a shock when something has a commercial. How could this be?
I mean, the very fact that we're talking about how successful Saladin's work has been, despite that, that alone shows how things have.
I have something else I want to say about that too, but you've got your hand up for a while.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So I find this a bit of a problem. Like, I am, a white woman, but if I want to write about another culture, I have I struggle with trying to make sure that I'm not being culturally appropriative. Like, it's like a massive struggle, I find, because, stereotypes are incredibly harmful.
Sure.
So how do you, overcome those kinds of boundaries so that you're respectful enough? And, even doing insurmountable research, I still feel uncertain that I'm even doing it correctly.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, first of all, is there a particular culture that you're looking
at? Oh, me personally?
Yeah.
Default that we've been talking about, right? Per se. Okay.
If you are oriented around a particular culture, and there's no reason to be, but say if you were, a white female writing about a Middle Eastern culture, what you do the absolute best you can do, keeping that in mind. and then, you know, get somebody who's of the culture to read it. Because, you know, nobody's perfect. We're the product of the culture in which we are raised, which, frankly, is very ethnocentric. And we will say racist things without even thinking, without even realizing that they are, even when we're trying not to.
I'm from Hawaii, and, you know, like, there's a lot of socio-political things that I didn't even realize growing up there because I just wasn't a part of those cultures that were being oppressed because,
right.
You know, even though I'm in Hawaii and it's a big melting pot, even as a minority there, like, because most of the people there aren't white, I still had privilege that I wasn't aware of, right?
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, how do I talk about those issues but not sound like I'm coming from privilege?
Well,
because I'm writing a character who isn't supposed to be coming from that.
First of all, it's an excellent question. You should be glad that you're asking it. That's the first thing.
The very fact that you ask it helps.
Yeah. The second thing I would say is, and you're right, this is something that, you know, people struggle with who are people that are trying to do the right thing. I'd say there's a couple of answers to that we've sort of found, not only in my own research, but in the work that I've done with Speculate and elsewhere. The first is that the amount of research that you have available to you now at this time in history is greater than at any period in history ever. The amount of available information that you have about some of this stuff is enormous, not just the amount of research that you wouldn't know how to get to, but people asking these exact same questions. So that helps a little bit. So I would recommend a couple of possible ways to go about it. One is listening to interviews and discussions of authors who have gone through this, either who are writing from a majority culture of it or something. Well, I wasn't going to be like Speculate. You know, Speculate is an example. Actually, the first episode we ever did of Speculate was of a issue of Apex in which Saladin and Amal El-Muttar had written stories, and they were writing about stories that had a specifically Islamic focus, not necessarily an Arabian Islamic focus, but an Islamic focus from different aspects of that, right? So that we don't assume, therefore, Islam goes here and this goes here, because that's not true either. That was extraordinarily fascinating to me. And one of the things that I do, and I'm very lucky in this regard, is we've done 100 episodes. Each one of these episodes to me is kind of like a masterclass, you know. So I'm asking a question, like, what about this? And then I'm furiously, you know, writing down notes because this is all grist for my mill, right? It's all stuff that I'm able to use then going forward. So listening to shows like Speculate, and there are many, many others like this, that do interviews, that discuss the work, that talk about these kinds of issues are very helpful because even if they don't say, the way to address cultures of this particular kind, even if they don't do that, simply osmotically by absorbing the zeitgeist, right, the things that are coming in that people are talking about, it will make it much more likely that you're going to write about this stuff sensitively and with thought. The other thing I would say is that there's a great benefit to, as you produce work, being able to sort of run it by people. I'd be careful about going to find someone from that culture because it's a little problematic too. But I would say that at least being able to look at your work, if you can, through the lens of the place from which you're writing it. For example, I wrote a story called The Caretaker of Meyer, which appeared in an anthology last year. And that story was originally set in more or less a version of the New Orleans Bayou, right? And there, I have these creatures there that are called alleys. They're essentially alligators. When I used the word alleys, I had an editor who said, you know, I'm not really sure that people are going to get this right off. I'm thinking you might want to try for gators. It's not what I wanted, because gators are basically found in Florida. You're not going to hear people in the bayou talking about gators. You'll mostly hear them talking about alleys, because it comes from a Francophone culture. There's a lot of reasons as to why. That was a particular flavor that I wanted to represent, not the South monolithic area, but the bayou area and a particular area of the bayou within the American South that would have a corollary to this fantasy world that I had created. So I had done some research by that, and I was able to do things like looking on, for example, YouTube and looking at listening to podcasts and doing some research from people who had talked about world building and world building in non-majority cultures, you know, your non-majority culture, whatever's not majority to you, that sort of thing. And doing that, sort of putting all those things together, made it possible for me to do this. Again, I am myself a white male who grew up in the Northeast, and you know, I cannot change, you know, where I came from and who I am. But what I can do is ask the right questions and do the right research and be continually conscious of questioning my own default positions. And if you do that, I think you'll find that what you should not do, I'll say this, what you should not do is avoid it altogether because of fear that you'll get it wrong. Because if we do that, then I guarantee you this is not going to change, and we're going to be stuck with, you know, white folks writing to white folks and American white folks writing to American white folks and Northeastern American white folks, et cetera, rather than actually being able to broaden out. So it's an excellent question, and I think if you are able to do research and listen to interviews and listen to podcasts and do stuff like that, you will absorb a lot of this, I would say, to begin.
And, like, avoid generalizations.
Yes. Yes, and being able to do that by looking at, you know, aspects of dialect and language and the way those things change. And I think you can do that. First of all, it's enjoyable research. I think you can do that without feeling like you can never actually get started writing. You can be writing as you're doing this research as well, I think.
And go, I mean, whenever you're dealing with another culture, look at it with respect, because you're not, when you're writing, you're not a Caucasian talking about this story from their point of view. That's, you know, it...
That's a 19th century travelogue.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is a problem.
It's, their culture is every bit as, you know, as rich, as, what is the word? Legitimate as ours. Absolutely. And, I mean, like, and it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to do when you come from the privileged culture in our society. You know, sometimes we think, well, it's almost as legitimate, but no, it's absolutely as legitimate.
I'd add into this, by the way, that what we're also talking about is also just good writing.
Yeah.
You know, if you try to put yourself in the position of a villain, right, or one of your characters that you dislike, and you are incapable of putting yourself in the position of that character and providing the motivation, you're not going to be writing that character particularly well. You'll be creating a two-dimensional, flat, stereotype version of what a real person would be. So this sort of thing is, beyond everything else that we've talked about, also just good writing. Leave aside the fact that it's the right thing to do, culturally important, etc. It also is just good writing on top of everything else, so I want to make sure that we have that as well. I think you had your hand in the back, and then we'll get up to you as well. Yeah.
Other than the one you mentioned, do you guys have any recommendations for, like, publishers, maybe small press or something, genre publishers that publish, like, some of this kind of stuff?
Daw is great.
For a big one, yep. I'd think of three. One is a press called Verbe Noir, which I believe got its start, I want to say, about 3 or 4 years ago. It had its genesis in Race Fail, if you know a little bit about that online thing that was going on. It's called Verbe Noir, V-E-R-B-N-O-I-R-E, I believe that's right. They produce work that is dealing with people of color and also dealing with people of different cultures and tries to be very broad. Dragon Moon Press, which is a small press out of Canada that I had a story in an anthology there's a year ago or so, also has produced a lot of good work that deals also with gender and sexuality and things like that, and not just you know, race and culture, but they're also a good one that I could recommend. And then some of the smaller, not you know, small, but one of the smaller imprints, places like Orbit that I've mentioned, which is the one that does Nora Jemison's work, and Pyre. My friend Brenda Cooper had two books that came out from them. The Creative Fire. And I don't remember the second one, which just came out, but is retelling the story of Evita on a spaceship, so to speak. It's good work because Brenda's a very good writer. But this is another example of a press that's doing stuff of that kind. So Orbit is good. Also Pyre, which is Lou Anders' press, PYR. Pyre also is another one that's doing that as well. And there's tons and tons of others, but those are good just to kind of get a start as possible places to start looking. Yeah.
One second.
Yeah, he was.
Someone
you were up. Oh, okay. You had one you wanted to.
I can remember.
Okay.
So one of the things that this brings up for me is also how easily people write their cultures into other cultures.
Mm, yeah.
Because one of the things for me as a pagan that drives me nuts is people come up, they create pantheon religions based on the Judeo-Christian idea of good and evil. If you look at actual pantheistic religions, the concept of good and evil, there may be entities that do mainly negative things, but in some pantheons, and some not at all, but this idea of good and evil is not a thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that also is people recreate sexism, they recreate homophobia, even when they have, like, female characters struggling against it, it looks exactly like it does in this culture. And it's also people are operating on the same value system from this culture. And when and it's a constant struggle for me to try to step out of my ethnocentricity, to try to be like, how do people interpret things in this other culture? Are romantic relationships even as important as family, other family relationships? What are the motivations? How does this, you know, like, so a lot of it is also trying to step outside of your ethnocentricity, and I know that I'm constantly struggling with it, even though, like, I'm aware of it from both sides, like, you know, being white and trying to do culture, I'm constantly trying to be like, how can I take this these cultural values out so I can find out what their cultural values are, and then from the other perspective of constantly being frustrated of people recreating cultures where the only relationships are between men and women, and or even just, like, homophobic, there's no poly people, there's no, you know, just, like, all of these things being constantly recreated.
There's my friend Maurice Broaddus wrote, he kind of challenged a little bit, he loves steampunk, but he was annoyed about the fact that he said, you never see people of color that appear in steampunk. So he said this, he said the reason that he did this was because he got drunk and had a Twitter account, which is a bad combination.
That's why I don't have a Twitter account.
Yeah, that's why I don't drink. That way I avoid that problem. It's one or the other. Both of them is bad. Anyway, so he wrote this thing. He said, I'm so frustrated with steampunk that I'm going to write a series called Pimp My Airship. And I'm going to do it, which involves it. And so he does that on Twitter. And about 5 minutes later, he gets publishers starting to, oh, I'd really like to see that. Make sure you send me that thing. Like, so we did. So he wrote this series called Pimp My Airship. He did. And the sort of, and the funny part, which is, and it has, it sort of takes steampunk, but it makes assumptions, of, it makes it sort of heavily Jamaican. And there's other things that he does with it, which he has now renamed Steamfunk. And that's awesome because it's Maurice. But one of the things that he talks about is that was taking something that sort of went the other direction, taking things where we assume we know exactly what we're getting when we walk into a steampunk novel, which is lots of gears and lots of steam and lots of white, and changing it and sort of doing different things with it to sort of give people a sense of the other side of that equation that you're talking about. You know, what happens when you undercut and break apart assumptions of that kind. I wouldn't go so far as to say that we're that's the non-Western set of foundations. Sure, but he would admit that too.
Yes.
That was not his point, but my the point that I'm making here is I don't want to go into that too far except to say that, yeah, I mean, they both directions, part of doing that is to kind of point out what happens when people do exactly what you're talking about, which is to overlay, you know, their sense of what majority culture assumptions are on this other place, and because they've titled it with some name that seems exotic, that therefore means it's non-Western, and that's not true. So,
yeah, Nisi Shaw actually has coming out a steampunk novel that is based in the Belgian Congo.
Yep.
And, you know, from her, it's definitely not going to be white ethnocentric.
No, no, no. She said she hates steampunk, and so she also wanted to write something that was not this way. Yeah,
well,
sure.
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. You remember the... You remember
yes,
the
thing? Yes, definitely.
Okay.
First, what I said earlier, probably none of you remember, but and a lot of things, to me, a lot of things that have been said here, they don't just apply to this crevice, they apply to pretty much any crevice that we're dealing with here, which is a lot. There's so many. I just wanted to point that out. I forgot to point it out in the first part. I love the specific advice you gave them. Research is super important. Whether my favorite is not going and finding people, but people you already know that know more about that than you do. Mm-hmm. Going to them and then moving from there research, because obviously the internet and books are not always as trustworthy as your friends. And your friends, you can kind of tell when they actually know what they're talking about and when they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're talking about. That. Don't know what you're talking about. That is over. So I have specific advice for you with writing. I don't want anyone to think I'm an expert on this. I just I haven't written any books. I just write for D&D. I make characters from D&D, and the idea of writing a character first comes from D&D because I don't fill in the traits and the backstory before I fill in the personality. Because the personality is, what is this character going to be? What are their values? What do they want to do? What are they going to do? And then the backstory kind of follows from that. So if you start from there, it's like you can not know what you're going to write about. You cannot know where the story takes place. Especially for D&D, like, I don't know, if I'm not the DM, I don't know the setting. So I can have a character, I have a personality that can go with any character, basically, already ready. And so that goes into my writing, too, as a DM. And so you start there, and then you get to the research, and then you start values, and then you start traits and backstories, because obviously traits
yep.
change as well with the setting, at least somewhat. And so there's different orders, but the main thing is starting with the personality. And so that's my advice to you, basically.
Yeah, the one thing I'd say about that I would say, I agree with some of that, but I do think it's important, and I'm not saying you're saying this again, but I want to put this caveat out. I do think it's important not to assume that people are created in a vacuum, separate from the experience of where they live and where they grew up. So one of the things that I find you have to do, and I've done in my writing increasingly, and part of this is because of these master classes I mentioned, which is the information you get from these folks all the time, is that in a way these things are of a piece. The world that you create and the characters that are driven by that world, they are shaped by and shape the world in turn. And so thinking of these characters as being part of their experience and shaping the experiences that others will have as well is extremely important. And I think that it's important to do that in part because it makes it much less likely that the characters will seem as if they are out of place or slapped in or kind of like I took it and kind of inserted this. You know, a character, to use the D&D example, a character that comes out of a Dark Sun universe, which is driven by a desert world that where magic has ravaged the land and all those sorts of things, that's a very type of character, a different kind of character than what you're going to find in the standard Forgotten Realms setting or the Greyhawk setting, which is much more, you know, wonderful rolling fields and forests. And yes, it's dark, but eventually we get to go back and have some tea. That's, you know, Dark Sun is not that way. So, and again, I know that wasn't what you were claiming, but I want to make sure that we're clear that I do think developing characters and worlds in synchronicity with each other, I think, is important, and I think makes it much less likely that we'll run into those circumstances
add-on
as well.
Okay,
quick, because I want to make sure that Brent and we get other people.
How I usually see people write is the opposite of what I just said. So basically, I'm just saying I reverse engineer. So there are other things have to follow this from a reverse engineer standpoint, basically.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's when you do something in isolation from the culture, it's way too easy to only think in terms of what would be normal in your culture.
Right, you return to the default problem.
Because you end up with, you know, a white guy, you know, who happens to look brown, or happens, and it's just, and all the attitudes, all the sensibilities are Northwestern or Northeastern American.
Yep. You had your hand in the back too, I think, right?
Is that most people actually pretty carefully curate their friend group, and there are a lot of them, while you will get some insight into different ways, will still reflect your cultures and your values back at you.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Been the black friend in several occasions.
Yeah.
And not being able to talk about experiences that I haven't had, you know, which are still considered stereotypical.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And I do think that's one of the reasons why these things need to be done as part of a group. You know, that's why the research is important. And that's why I mentioned the thing about listening to interviews and podcasts, because it avoids the problem of having to, let me go find a person of color and ask them how they feel. It's not their job to instruct you on how not to be an ass. You know, I take that point. I think that's very important. I think the one thing that can't happen is people running away from fear. sphere. There, because the information is so readily available now, that's why. And because I think you can absorb it. Again, another way to do this, beyond just the specific research I talked about with you, is just to be reading more broadly and reading more widely. Go read the work of Saladin Ahmed and Alia Dubedard, and go read the work of Nora Jemison, right? And go, you know, read the work of people who are looking at that and also looking at gender. Look at the work of people like Leah Peterson and Elizabeth Baer, and look at these people who are writing about stuff that isn't just the standard, which you're going to get from anywhere. And you will find the more that you do that, the more that this stuff is going to become a part of your consciousness, and you will begin to absorb other values than just, you know, the majority values that you talk about that we tend to get at.
And so, read outside the genre as well.
Yeah, outside the genre is very important. As I said, since our genre is a little bit behind, I think, on this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And travel to that as well.
No, sorry, second.
If you have an opportunity to travel internationally.
Yeah, that's true, too.
And that's, you know,
yeah. To travel and mostly listen and watch. Please not... Not to sort of, but let me, you know what this reminds me of is when I, please, no, just travel and watch and listen, I think is the best thing you do. Sir, you had?
I was going to say the biggest help I've been able to have doing this is being able to go into it about being something genuinely curious about an area, being genuinely curious about a culture and not thinking, I want to write a story that's set in Tanzania. That's not a way to start it, unless you've got an interest in Tanzania already. That's not the right way to approach it. Then it kind of becomes sort of a tokenism.
Mm-hmm.
But if you genuinely become interested in culture and start immersing yourself in it and learning
stuff,
then the story ideas come, and you're approaching it from a broader place.
I agree.
The story ideas are often a hell of a lot more interesting than what you would come up with otherwise.
Under normal circumstances.
Because they come out of the culture that you're looking at.
Yeah, you had in the back. Yeah.
Just a quick side note to your point, which was a great point. A fun little side spin on that trope can be writing from the perspective of the character that everyone expects to be, you know, applying to these X stereotypes and then finding out that they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that can be, you know, okay, well, I have had these cultural differences from you, but at the same time, you know, I have these same cultural issues. So
you're saying I should sell my life story for $1 million?
Why not? Why not? But it's a fun little side spin of, you know, okay, this is something that, you know, you might not have expected to be able to relate to because I have had that same experience you have.
You do want to, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely what you're saying. Sometimes you might want to be a little careful about that, because when you are turning a trope on its end like that, you want to get them thinking you're in that, following that trope before you turn it upside down, and you can lose people because it looks like that trope to start.
You're breaking the author contract. They think it's this, and then you're flipping
upside. And you're losing in some cases, you may end up losing exactly the people that you're trying to appeal to.
Yeah, because a poorly executed reversal is often worse, like poorly executed satire. Bad satire is really bad. Great satire is enormously helpful and useful. And so, anyway, but bad satire is, or you know, bad reversals, if done poorly, can kind of make things worse in a way. Sure.
Yeah, so like I don't like the word reversal myself, like turned in any number of the 360, it could be turned on. You gotta make sure that whatever you're turning it to is a value that they, or an experience that they could actually, that makes sense for their culture to have too. Like, it's easy to, like, I see a lot of times when people just take their stereotype and just flip it, exactly. And that's not necessarily real for that culture.
Well, and also what you're doing, if you flip a stereotype that way, you've essentially, you've created a mirror image and thus are dominated by the same stereotype. If you're reversing into exactly the opposite, it means you've played into precisely the same stereotype you started with. It's just that you're pretending it's everything but this, okay? It's everything but the elephant in the room. Well, you're still focusing on the elephant in the room, ultimately. But I think, you know, part of, and this is what the gentleman said about the not wanting to write a story in Tanzania, and that's your whole thing, but part of that is continuing to sort of broaden the conversation so that we don't look at it as something that has to have its own panel or be something which is sort of looked at separately. I think we do need to do that at the moment because I don't think we as a genre have taken this seriously enough, and I don't think that we've approached it seriously enough, and I think there's been a lot of fear and a great deal of defensiveness on the part of people who have said, I'm not that way, so the hell with, you know, go away, and then they walk away. So I do think that we need to have that, but I think our goal needs to be to get to the point where we're reading and writing great stories that reflect the cultural diversity, not just of, you know, the world in general, but also of our readership. You know, if you do studies of, you know, the readership of most of these books, again, I go back to that Le Guin example. The fact that you had people coming up to her and saying, thank you for writing me into a story, to me, is tragic. It's horrifically bad, and it means that we need to stop assuming that the default reader is also white male. That's not accurate either, and it's also not accurate that they are default American or default British. You know, you're talking about a very broad approach. We just got done with a series of shows on the work of Garth Nix and Sean Williams, and we were doing a middle grade book called Trouble Twisters. This book, Trouble Twisters, is set in Portland. Now, if you all think for a minute, you could probably think about a Portland that might pop into your mind, because we're on the West Coast, you might think Portland, Oregon. I grew up in the Northeast, so I thought Portland, Maine. Sean, who I believe came up with the name originally, has a Portland, New Zealand. The truth is, if you do a quick study, you'll find that there are tons of Portlands. It's like saying Main Street in America. Like, tons of towns have a Main Street, right? Tons of countries in the world have a Portland of some kind. The fascinating thing about that is that while Portland itself is extremely well-defined, you know, that has a lighthouse and certain and a playground that is very well described, and it has a sewer system that's very unusual, and the houses are sort of old and rickety but filled with character, whatever. It's an interesting town, but it is outside of itself rootless. That is to say, it's not really, you know, it could be Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon, or Portland, New Zealand, or Portland, UK, or Portland anything, right? And one of the interesting things about that was they had deliberately tried for something which would be well-described and well-defined in and of itself, but which wouldn't necessarily lock you in a particular place. Why? Because they wanted readers to assume and imagine themselves existing in that town, whatever Portland it happened to be. And so I use that example to say that there is, I think, an opportunity for us also to be able to produce work which is specific but not necessarily rooted in a particular, you know, locale. But I do think then it becomes even more important, even more imperative, that you not go back to the cultural default that we've been talking about before, that you are in the process of creating new cultural imaginations, that you are drawing upon other cultures in the world, establishing that in an anthropologically logical way, it can be done, to be able to establish your own world this way. And that also may help you get from being caught up in this, but if I talk about Portland, Maine, that's going to be, then they won't know if it's in Portland, Oregon. You know, they got rid of all that and said, instead, let's focus on the detail and the interest of the particular space in place that we wanted to write about, and not the space is tied into all of these other things that are sort of surrounding it. And that's another, I think, interesting way to look at this. Not the only way, but it's another way, another tool in the toolbox, as my friend Brad says, to sort of use that too. So
we are just about out of time. Do we want to do a last...
Any thoughts?
Don't be afraid. It's way too easy. I mean, more recently you got a lot of, you know, a lot of people talking about cultural appropriation. It's like, you know, treat things with respect and then write it. Try, do your best. You may not make everything as good as you'd like, but you're not going to do it at all if you're afraid to do it. And, you know, the next one, you find you make a mistake, it's like, oh crap, I won't do that next time.
And a lot of those apply over more than one specific culture.
Right. Yeah, I would say
the mistake is based on your culture, not their culture.
Yeah I would.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
Just a quick point to make. Writing in fantasy is actually you have a sort of cheat. You don't have to set the culture in the specific geographic location that you're writing about. You still derive its elements. You still, of course, treat the culture with respect and immerse yourself in it. And as that gentleman made a very good point, actually have a passion for, feeling for that culture. But you can avoid, you know, stepping into subtle potholes by setting it on a different planet. And I think that's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah. More freedom.
I would say don't be fearful. Do your research. Do not opt out of the discussion. That is what you cannot do. You must be part of it. You must be part of writing to change it. And part of that is doing research, not being fearful of it, and continuing to work.
I think the guy mentioned having previous interest in this area. No, just know that the new, when you're writing about it and you intend to share that, there's more work involved if you want to get it right.
The more work, I think, is the key. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.